Skepticism and ideology. Deconstruction, deeply academic and self-involved though it mostly was, supported a general move towards relativist principles in postmodernist culture. It left postmodernists not particularly interested in empirical confirmation and verification in the sciences. They often saw this as contaminated by an association with the military-industrial complex, the use of a rigid technological rationality for social control, and so on. It also meant that the followers of Lyotard and Derrida tended to believe in stories rather than in testable theories. Postmodernists, having abandoned their belief in traditional, realistic philosophy, history, and science under the influence of French thought, thus became more and more the theorizers of the delusive workings of culture. And that is why most of my examples of the application of the philosophical and political ideas of postmodernism are drawn from the arts. Postmodernist thought sees the culture as containing a number of perpetually competing stories, whose effectiveness depends not so much on an appeal to an independent standard of judgment as upon their appeal to the communities in which they circulate, like rumor in Northern Ireland. As Saleh Benhabib points out in Situating the Self from 1992, for Lyotardians, transcendental guarantees of truth are dead. In the agonal struggle of language games, there is no commensurability. There are no criteria of truth transcending local discourses, but only the endless struggle of local narratives vying with one another for legitimation. Postmodernism thus involved a highly critical epistemology, hostile to any overarching philosophical or political doctrine, and strongly opposed to those dominant ideologies that help to maintain the status quo. Nevertheless, many postmodernists allied the Derridian style of critique to a more constructively subversive ideology. They saw that pointing out an unwitting allegiance to a contradictory position, like that of Tennyson, was very much what Marx and Freud had been up to. Marx had maintained that workers are in a state of false consciousness. They assent to the bourgeois proposition that they are giving their labor freely as autonomous individuals to the market, but they are really imprisoned by economically determined structures of class antagonism. This was known with certainty to Marxist theorists of this period, and in very non-Derridian terms, as real power relations. Freudians could similarly argue that the conflict between the superego, conforming to socially sanctioned beliefs, and unconscious, secret, or repressed desires, for example, for sexual expression, would inevitably lead to internal contradictions, which are open to a Derridian reading. And so, paradoxically enough, in concentrating on the notion of hidden contradiction, many postmodernists allied themselves to two highly disputable and certainly totalizing 19th-century ideologies. Of course, it is possible to point out such ideology-undoing internal contradictions without claiming at the same time to have an alternative overall solution to society's problems. One can analyze contradictions to point to social tension without implicitly offering a general Marxist or Freudian solution, simply by promoting the thesis discussed above, that all language systems will be found to contain contradictions because they are essentially metaphorical. Not surprisingly, this aspect of postmodernism appealed immensely to literary and cultural critics, who could apply themselves to any material, and not just to those texts, particularly poems or historical periods such as the Romantic era, which pretty well asked for their contradictions to be revealed. The deconstructive methods of philosophy were easily adapted to the paradox-hunting, metaphor-undoing techniques of literary theory, to which they gave an often spurious and portentous significance. In the work of Dumas, Hillis Miller, and other Yale-situated disciples of Derrida, a great deal of enlivening attention was paid to the self-defeating rhetoric of argument in literary works and elsewhere, particularly by an analysis of their hidden metaphors of the kind exemplified above. Works of art were seen as inexorably disabled by the contradictory implications of the figurative, and so, and this is the point, they were cut off from any reliable relationship to history and from any sustained claims as to matters of empirical fact. In this way, the philosophy behind deconstruction inspired a huge expansion of interest in literary theory, whose concerns came to dominate whole schools of literary criticism. The best protection against this kind of critique, and the best way of signaling that one was up to date enough to be aware of it, whether in doing philosophy, making theory, or creating art, was to become very self-conscious indeed concerning one's own position, and to build in the appropriate qualifications about it. This self-conscious reflexivity, whose symptom was a frequent recourse in meta-languages, was seen by some as the hallmark of philosophy under postmodern conditions. In a great amount of postmodernist work, then, a reflexive self-critique or regress is literally written into the text. This can be seen in Godard's films, which are, according to the Marxist theorist Frederick Jameson, cited in Hans Burton's The Idea of the Postmodern from 1994, resolutely postmodernist in that they conceive of themselves as sheer text, as a process of production of representations that have no truth content, are in this sense sheer surface or superficiality. It is this conviction which accounts for the reflexivity of the Godard film, its resolution to use representation against itself to destroy the binding or absolute status of any representation. This postmodernist awareness of the work as text, even if it is a film or a painting or a fashion show, sees any significant cultural product as continuous with all other uses of natural language. This avoided any aesthetic privileging of the individual artwork and its unitary organization, which was seen as a typically modernist error. The claim was rather that the work had a continuity with all other texts. Postmodernist deconstruction thus forced another parallel between the discourse of philosophy, a highly technical discipline which returns again and again to the same problems and roots out contradictions, and that of works of art, and indeed all the discourses of society. Given the severe restraints that it placed upon the possibility of achieving the unity of coherent argument, and the great suspicion that arose concerning the more or less hidden debt of any work or text to its predecessors, it came to be thought that any text, from philosophy to the newspapers, involved an obsessional repetition or intertextuality. Just as much as philosophy, which since Plato has worried away at the same old problems, the novel will inevitably reproduce or re-represent earlier positions, earlier ideas, conventional modes of description, and so on. And not only Joyce's Ulysses, that is, a deliberately elusive modernist work, can do this. As Umberto Eco, a significant postmodern theorist, put in his amazingly popular postmodernist novel, The Name of the Rose, books always speak of other books, and every story tells a story that has already been told. This view ends up in a kind of textual idealism, because all texts are seen as perpetually referring to other ones, rather than to any external reality. No text ever finally establishes anything about the world outside itself. It never comes to rest, but merely, to use Derrida's term, disseminates variations on previously established concepts or ideas. Rewriting history. As I have already asserted, all this activity kept realism of all kinds in the dock. To attempt any form of realism was to fall into philosophical error, and so the attempt to write history from the hitherto dominant positivist or empiricist point of view was doomed to failure. Once again, postmodernist thought, by analyzing everything as text and rhetoric, tended to push hitherto autonomous intellectual disciplines in the direction of literature. History was just another narrative, whose paradigm structures were no better than fictional, and was a slave to its own, often unconsciously used, unrealized myths, metaphors, and stereotypes. Its sources, however objective or evidence-based they might seem to be, were in the end just another interrelated series of multiply interpretable texts, and even its causal explanations could be shown to derive from, and hence to repeat, well-known fictional plots. This view of the writing of history is an essential test of postmodernist doctrine as it affects all parts of our culture. If even history fails, under postmodernist scrutiny, to come up to the previously dominant realist or positivist criteria for its writing, then literature, which is further removed from history, cannot make any strong realist claims either. The basic postmodernist claim here is that the notion of objective reconstruction, according to the evidence, is just a myth. Historians can't simply tell us how things were or how they are, because, as Alan Munslow puts it, all meaning is generated by socially encoded and constructive discursive practices that mediate reality so much that they effectively close off direct access to it. History is therefore at base just another more or less socially acceptable narrative, competing for our attention and our assent. Just another way of putting things, which will survive or not, through a process of discussion and debate. What is more, its elaborate causal constructions and explanations are essentially put together in a way that fictional narratives are. As Hayden White writes in The Historical Text as a Literary Artifact in his Tropics of Discourse from 1978, historical narratives are verbal fictions, the contents of which are as much invented as found, and the forms of which have more in common with their counterparts in literature than they have with those in the sciences. All history books tell you a story where the most basic evidence or facts, such as that Napoleon was short or that Cleopatra's nose was a beautiful one and not a centimeter too long, can give rise to interminable, essentially disputable interpretations, which also make factual claims, for example, "And therefore Napoleon was compensatorily aggressive, and Cleopatra irresistibly attractive." For these judgments will in their turn fit into larger, typical narratives, in which, for example, Napoleon's conquests are largely to be interpreted as manifestations of his character rather than of underlying economic conditions. Or, as Shakespeare seems to have believed following Plutarch, Antony fled from the Battle of Actium because of Cleopatra's amazing erotic appeal. It doesn't matter whether the storyteller here is a great historian or William Shakespeare. They both fix upon a narrative shape or genre for what they have to tell us, which they will borrow from the currently available conventions for making them. Some postmodernist-influenced histories, for example, Simon Schama's Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution from 1989, and Orlando Figgis's A People's Tragedy, The Russian Revolution, 1891-1921 from 1996, make this narrative function quite clear. We are following a story, but no historian can claim that this one is the story, even if that is what he or she is aiming at. Apart from anything else, the relationship between the invented or constructed and the found or the evidential will always be a matter of dispute or interpretation. This is certainly so for the complex cases that are most interesting to us. Very simple accounts, which show that the relationship of fact to story can at least in some cases be indisputable, won't get us very far with an understanding of the cultural practices of writing history of the kind that counts in the world, such as informs our understanding of the relationship of American historical writing to beliefs about the Cold War, or of the left-wing history of dissent and opposition, or whether the Rosenbergs were guilty, or how Kennedy came to be shot in Texas, and the cultural selectivity, from this point of view, of most historical accounts has been amply demonstrated by feminist historians. What is more, at the most basic level, the novelist and the historian will be using a language full of tropes or metaphors. These also signify to us the way in which history is far from being concerned with mere literal facts. It isn't just the causal relationships of the historical plot that are at issue here, but all the conventional and not-so-conventional pathways in language that we have inherited. And from this, according to the postmodernists, other characteristics of history might be expected to flow. Most obviously, if the very possibility of a realist history is denied, if facts are always to be seen as merely relative to the theoretical presuppositions which constitute them, and to the interpretations which are made of them, and if the evidence is always to be seen in relation to the construction of a context for it, even the most dry as dust, apparently non-narrative approach to historical evidence or primary sources will inevitably carry narrative presuppositions. History will have an essentially mythological shape, which reveals itself most clearly in fiction and provides the basic conceptual structure for history. If it is accepted that the use of such essentially interpretive structures is inevitable, then postmodernist relativism is the norm, because these competing myth-derived structures are clearly in competition. If direct access to the past is denied, all we can have are competing stories, which are variously given coherence by their historian narrators, and the past is no more than what the historians, whom we rely upon for various cultural reasons, try to say that it is. And what is more, for many postmodernists, the narrative structures favored by historians will carry unavoidable and possibly objectionable philosophical or ideological implications. For example, a far too novelistic and bourgeois belief in the importance of individual human agency, in preference to an attribution to underlying economic structures, as in the examples cited above. But what, then, of our sense of the true, the reliable, the probably true, when we read history? Even consciously postmodernist reconstructionists are trying to help us to form better beliefs about what they think actually happened. And there is such a thing as more or less adequately descriptive narrative. A large amount of correspondence between language and reality is possible. Hardly anyone is in favor of suppressing what is generally accepted as evidence. There is a strong sense in which historians are not free just to make things up, as controversy over the Holocaust deniers has shown. But then realist novelists aren't particularly free to make things up either. They have to know much of what the historian knows, and more. Postmodernist relativism needn't mean that anything goes, or that faction and fiction are the same as history. What it does mean is that we should be more skeptically aware, more relativist about, more attentive to, the theoretical assumptions which support the narratives produced by all historians, whether they see themselves as empiricists or deconstructors, or as postmodernist new historicists. This applies as much to postmodernist as to traditional historians. To give an example, reported in Richard Evans's In Defense of History, when Diane Purkis attacks Keith Thomas's account of witches as being often enough powerless old beggar women, she says that he is simply repeating an enabling myth in which men's historical identity is grounded in the powerlessness and speechlessness of women. Richard Evans replies to this, in support of Thomas, that poor single old women were often accused of witchcraft because, far from being speechless, they cursed those men who refused them alms. It seems as though Thomas's empirical claims here have simply run foul on Purkis's rival organizing principle for historical narrative, that it should be used to support contemporary notions of female empowerment. An exact correspondence between narrative and the past is not possible. We can describe the same event in many different ways. Our access to the evidence is always mediated. Nothing is simply transparent. And there are always absences and gaps and biases to be dealt with. But narratives can still be more or less adequate to the interpreted evidence, and new evidence can still overturn narratives. Moreover, not all literary forms of narrative are equally appropriate to historical periods and events. As Munslow points out, the 1944 Warsaw Ghetto Uprising is not equally appropriately narrated, and therefore well interpreted, if it is seen as romance, as farce, and as tragedy. The best we can have is a debate about the nature and meaning of past events, and postmodernists, and plenty of others, say that this debate should be kept as open and as rigorous as possible. The penalty of a lack of vigilance is that some official version may come to represent for us a true and final account of the past. It may also thus come to form part of an unjustifiable, because clearly distorting, dominant ideology within its receiving society, as seems to have happened to both sides in the period of the Cold War. On this account, the deconstructionist historian differs from the others only in a tendency to worry aloud, as he or she writes, about the difficulties of the job. Attacking science. Postmodernists got into their most radical political positions and their most obvious difficulties in attacking the objectivist claims of science. For scientists obviously think of themselves as contributing to the construction of some unifying theory or grand récit for their subject matter, and they think that they are trying to complete a picture of what is really out there, though this formulation also has its obviously misleading metaphorical model behind it. Can we have a picture of a black hole or of an n+4-dimensional space? The claims of science were to be called into question, and yet who could now seriously deny the grand narrative of evolution, except someone in the grip of a far less plausible master narrative, such as creationism? And who would wish to deny the truth of basic physics? The answer was, some postmodernists, on the political grounds, inter alia, that the hierarchizing logic of scientific thought is inherently and objectionably subordinating. For example, Bruno Latour's absurd contention that Einstein's relativity theory is a contribution to the sociology of delegation, since it involves the writer, Einstein, of the scientific paper, imagining the sending out of observers to make timed measurements of events, which are then shown by the theory to be relative to one another. For Latour, it seems, social concepts can explain basic science. Most of us think of scientists as those who really know how things are. They reveal the nature of nature. Their knowledge of causal laws enables us to produce inventions that make a difference, like microchips. Their standards of evidence, of verification and general consensus, which ultimately control the paradigms or conceptual frameworks within which they work, are, or should be, the best we know. Far better, for example, than those current amongst economists. That is what a Nobel Prize means. But postmodernists do not like this picture. They have attacked the basic claims traditionally made by scientists. 1. That they can describe and analyze, objectively and truthfully, and therefore with a universal application, the physical reality which surrounds us. And 2. That their scientific inquiry is a disinterested pursuit of truths about reality, which are also universalizable, in that they are true everywhere, quite independent of any merely local cultural constraints, and in particular independent of any of the more or less hidden moral or ideological motivations which may have inspired their discovery. For postmodernists who are good relativists, scientists can have no such privileges. They promote just one story among many. Their pretensions are unjustified. They do not so much discover the nature of reality as construct it. And so their work is open to all the hidden biases and metaphors which we have seen postmodernist analysis reveal in philosophy and ordinary language. The key questions about science should not therefore just center on its inflated, logocentric claims to truth, but on the political questions aroused by its institutional status and application, shaped as they are by the ideological agendas of powerful elites. This is an extreme version of the relativism we have already encountered, for the attack on science is not just about philosophical constructions of the world, which have always been in dispute, but about those empirically based analyses of the world, in medicine and computer development, as much as in aeronautics and bomb manufacture, that seem to have been most successfully true. In considering this postmodernist attack, we need, in the interests of clarity, to keep the epistemological and ideological issues as separate as possible. It is, of course, the point that deconstructive postmodernists and their followers wish to make, that these two claims are not, from their point of view, separable at all. But I refuse simply to assume that they are right, for it is surely perfectly obvious and nothing new that the motivations for and consequences of scientific discovery are open to moral and political criticism. Many of those who worked on the atom bomb, notably Robert Oppenheimer, were acutely aware of that. Quantum mechanics, genetic engineering, and our scientific knowledge of the global climate, of course, have interestingly different relationships to the financing and pursuit of Western political and military objectives. But these contextual judgments can be accepted without it following that the core activities of scientists are somehow unsuccessful in arriving at the most reliable way of analyzing nature we can manage. There is something very odd indeed in the belief that in looking, say, for causal laws or a unified theory, or in asking whether atoms really do obey the laws of quantum mechanics, the activities of scientists are somehow inherently bourgeois or Eurocentric or masculinist or even militarist. This is, partly at least, because the truths of science, rather than those of politics or religion, seem as a matter of fact to be equally valid for socialist, African, feminist, and pacifist scientists, though some persons in these categories deny this. For empirical scientists only accept truths that have this universalizable character. Aspirin works everywhere. It is one of the things that they are not willing to be, politically or culturally, relativist about. Although every scientist can think of cases in which political pressures has led to bad science, as in the official Soviet view of plant genetics, Lysenkoism, and hopefully to good science, as in the investigation of AIDS, the results of such investigations will only stand in the long run within the community of scientists if they meet the usual tests, which are independent of any political context. As two professors of physics, Alan Sokal and Jean Bouyquemont, have devastatingly pointed out, postmodernist critics of science often grossly fail to understand the empirical claims of science and the ways in which its key theoretical terms work, and often substitute for them, when they apply scientific modes of thought to the political world, a number of tendentiously vague and misleading metaphors. The result is, as Sokal and Bouyquemont put it, mystification, deliberately obscure language, confused thinking, and the misuse of scientific concepts. For example, Jean Baudrillard claims that in the Gulf War, the space of the event has become a hyperspace with multiple refractivity, and the space of war has become definitively non-Euclidean. Sokal and Bouyquemont comment on this that the concept of hyperspace offered here simply does not exist in either mathematics or physics, and that it makes no sense to ask what a Euclidean space of war would be like, let alone to hypothesize the kind of space which Baudrillard has just invented through his misunderstanding and misuse of scientific terminology. And so one reply from scientists to postmodernists is that the latter may have an entirely worthy interest in the sociology and politics of science, but simply don't understand its actual workings and the nature of the truths it attempts to establish very well. This riposte parallels the reproach from philosophers in the Anglo-American tradition that postmodernists don't understand the workings and successes of logocentric philosophy very well either, and that this may be because the most prestigious postmodernist theorists don't seem to be very interested in constructive dialogue with anyone but each other. Their eagerness to embrace what seem to be politically correct positions has too often led them to express utterly bizarre and ill-informed, not to say politically biased, accounts of what scientists are doing. This is the main burden of the publications of Sokal and others, notably after Sokal in 1994 had a hoax account of scientific activity, full of elementary scientific howlers and non sequiturs, published by a postmodernist journal, Social Text. For many postmodernist attacks on science, which attempt to demonstrate the inherently political characteristics of empiricist Western scientific activity, are not just ill-informed, but peculiarly Pickwickian, in that they tend to do little more than import metaphors or analogies into the findings of science, to the point that under the kind of deconstructive analysis described above, they look as though they imply some kind of political statement or position that is in fact quite irrelevant to the truths they are trying to establish. For example, there is a much-referred-to article by the anthropologist Emily Martin on The Egg and the Sperm, which argues that the picture of egg and sperm drawn in popular as well as scientific accounts of reproductive biology relies on stereotypes central to our cultural definitions of male and female. The stereotypes imply not only that female biological processes are less worthy than their male counterparts, but also that women are less worthy than men. In such literature, it is asserted, we have a passive, coy damsel female egg versus the active, macho male sperm. And it does indeed seem that some textbook accounts do employ this tendentious imagery. But there is more to it than this. Patriarchal scientists are supposed by their postmodernist critics to have inevitably, given their subjective and politically contaminated presuppositions, got the science of this relationship wrong. For it is now believed that the female egg actively grabs the male sperm, which has swum a long way before this happens. But did male ideological presuppositions about male superiority and aggression as a matter of fact hold up or block the new view? Does it make sense, as an account of scientific activity, to say that any such presuppositions could have produced this particular holdup? This is not to deny that male preoccupations have indeed held up the proper investigation of female physiology. There are two issues here. One is the metaphorical resonance that various accounts of the egg and sperm have in relationship to gender stereotypes. For example, Scott Gilbert builds on this to write, vulgarly, about fertilization as a kind of marital gang rape. The egg is a whore attracting the soldiers like a magnet, and so on. But this resonance is, in any case, a gross exaggeration. No such phrases actually appear in the serious scientific literature on this subject. All of this metaphorical interpretation, typical though it is of postmodernist concerns, seems to me relatively trivial and silly, and doesn't have far to go, because anyone who wanted to generalize either view of sperm and egg relations to justify or explain the nature of any larger-scale male-female interactions would surely be expressing a ludicrous essentialism. It's been like that from the sperm and egg on. This sort of thing rather misses the point about the potential for adjustment in male-female relations, but it also makes a much more damaging second implication about science, that there was a failure of objectivity here, and that the new discovery corrected a masculinist bias in scientific work. But, as Paul Gross shows, it is quite false to claim that male scientists had ignored the active role of the female egg until prodded into admitting it by feminists. It had been pointed out by Just in 1919, also citing a paper of 1878, that the egg pulls in or engulfs the sperm. And this view was common, says Gross, in textbooks from 1920 onwards. All these radical postmodernist arguments are now under severe attack, but they have very much changed the way in which scientific disciplines are perceived within American and European culture, towards a more skeptical and politicized view. Of course, it hardly needs to be added that realist history and novel writing, filmmaking, science, and newspaper reporting also continued on their way in the era of postmodernist theory. They had a high level of general acceptability, so that many of those attracted to postmodernist art and theory must have found themselves living in two opposing epistemological worlds. This battle between postmodernists and others in philosophy and theory and history and science was basically about the claims of unificatory versus contradictionist talk, the contrast between cooperative constructing and individualist deconstructing. But each side needs the other. Postmodernists liberally opposed all holistic explanations, even if they sometimes readmitted them through the back door by promoting arguments which were in sympathy with those of Freud and Marx. And their oppositional, negative postmodernist critique was, as we shall see, in many ways immensely liberating, certainly for women, for cultural minorities, and for much of the artistic avant-garde. An artist's ideas can perhaps more truly be seen as play than those of a historian or scientist, or indeed of a lawyer, who could hardly apply a postmodernist skepticism to the law of evidence, or to the notion that one way or another, the courts are designed to test the truth or probability of two alternative accounts of what actually happened. Postmodernist critical techniques were much more successfully applied to ethical and social problems, for example to the undoing of the grand récit of patriarchy and the defense of women against its dominance. I now turn to these ethical and political concerns.